Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On a Wednesday, July 29th, welcome, 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 friends. On Into Studio 2, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. If you are paying rent, a mortgage, or in the market for a new home, you have likely noticed prices are steep, interest rates high, and supply limited. We're in a housing crisis. Prices have far exceeded incomes, and we're way behind on building, short between 2 and 7 million homes.
Yeah, and this housing crunch hits low-income people the hardest. Half of all renters today are cost-burdened, which means they spend more than 30% of their paycheck on housing. More than 12 million households pay over half their income on rent, and more Americans are also being shut out of home ownership.
And that brings us to our monthly Big Fix episode, where we tackle big problems facing the country, and today we're taking on housing. We've asked three experts to bring two big ideas to the table each for making housing more affordable and available to all. And we're going to debate them over the next hour. So let me first introduce said guests. Taya Nguyen is the executive director of the Community Design Collaborative and an adjunct professor in architecture and real estate at Temple and Thomas Jefferson Universities. Taya, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Yoni Applebaum, deputy executive editor of The Atlantic and author of Stuck, How the Privileged and the Property Broke the Engine of American Opportunity. Yoni, nice to see you.
So glad to join you again.
And let me finally welcome Mo Rushdie, managing partner of the River Wards Group and the past president of the Philadelphia Building Industry Association. Mo, thanks for being here in Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. Our questions of the day: how do you think we can make housing more affordable? Should we change zoning rules? Should we just build, build, build? What are your thoughts? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the live chat.
And quick aside before we launch into the conversation, it's another giveaway Wednesday, folks, all summer. We're giving out tickets to great events in the region, so stick around till the end of the show for today's reveal and your chance to win. Now let's get into the conversation.
Oh, yeah. So let me explain to our big thinkers how this works. We have two rounds, and each of you have been asked to provide us with two big ideas. We will have one round where each of you lay out one of your ideas, and we're going to start with Yoni. So Yoni, we understand that your big idea, and let me pull up my notes here, your big idea first is to set housing rules at the state level. That's your first big idea. So lay out the problem as you see it, and then give us your big idea solution.
Yeah, you know, I think that many Americans are acutely aware that housing has gotten really expensive, but it can be hard to recover just how weird this is. For most of American history, people moved toward the places that were thriving economically. That's where they found jobs, opportunities. It's where they could give their children the future they wanted them to have. And it's really only in the last few decades that we've seen Americans move away from places that are thriving economically to where the housing is cheap. And that's because the places that are producing those jobs, that offer those amenities, have made it impossibly hard to build enough housing to satisfy the demand. And that takes agency away from Americans. It means that they can't live where they want to live. They can't join the communities and contribute where they want to do that. There's a really thick tangle of rules. We often say zoning, but we also mean all kinds of things, from minimum lot sizes to building codes. There's a million ways that local municipalities have over time figured out how to decide who gets to join, who gets to belong to their communities by using the tools of land use law. So my big idea is this. This is all really, really new. Wherever your favorite neighborhood in say, Philadelphia might be, it almost certainly was built before America's first zoning codes were passed in the early 20th century. Many of the places we really love grew up and developed in the absence of these kinds of dense rules. And that's not a coincidence. We need a level playing field. We need builders to have the predictability to be able to use a design they've developed in one place and take it to another jurisdiction. It'd be great if companies specialized in building housing instead of navigating approvals processes. And it would be much more fair if every community in a state was playing by the same set of rules, using the same rule book, and applying it as a local community might decide to apply it.
And when we say rules, we're talking about zoning, building codes, what else? I mean, is that what's in the rule book essentially?
Yeah, you know, these rule books are really complicated. There are jurisdictions by the time you add up all the zoning designations and the overlays, where you can have a couple hundred combinations of rules just from the zoning guidelines that apply to that jurisdiction, and a map that looks less like zones and more like an intricate mosaic. We're also talking about general land use rules like setback requirements. Mm-hmm.
So all this would be uniform at the state level, which means it would override any rules set at the community level, or there just wouldn't be rules set at the community level.
Well, you know, the way that a lot of jurisdictions that have tried something like this, often outside of the United States, have done it is they've said, look, here are the categories. Japan faced a crisis like ours, where the prosperous places were no longer constructing enough housing, where the rules had gotten too tight and too restrictive and too complicated to navigate. And they said, look, we're going to have 10 zoning designations at the federal level, and then localities can apply those labels to their own land as they see fit, but they've got to use these 10 boxes, right? Like you can't.
That was going to be my question. You mentioned Japan and federal. Why not do this federally? Would you want to do it federally, or is this like a concession to the American system? We're going to do it state by state because that's just kind of how America works.
Yeah. So it turns out that all these building regulations are actually state powers. These were state powers that the states had to delegate down to municipalities about 100 years ago with enabling statutes. But they're newly invented powers. They didn't exist more than 100 years ago. They were then delegated by the states down to localities. And the states can set guidelines. They can say, look, you know, you can decide, you know, where your residential district is, where your industrial district is. But you got to use these labels. You can't invent your own rules or layer on too many requirements. And if you set these things at the state level, everybody's playing with those same labels, and it creates much greater predictability and fairness.
And I think about Pennsylvania, for example, very purple state, and there's always, you know, these are restrictions or zoning rules that would affect urban, you know, centers like Philadelphia, like Pittsburgh, which are very different from other parts of the state. And I wonder how you would go about implementing that. And then I want, you know, of course, Taya and Mo, please comment on this. But how would you implement something like that at the state level? We have a situation in Pennsylvania where you have a GOP run Senate and a Democratic run House, and you know, they rarely agree. They very rarely agree. So your thoughts on just getting that laid out?
You didn't tell me I had to get this through Harrisburg.
No, I think it's
a blue sky idea, not a purple sky idea. Now, come on, now.
Yeah, yeah. No, look, big changes can feel scary, right? I think fundamentally, this is about equity and fairness, where you don't want some jurisdictions, like a wealthy community on the main line, being able to say, we're not going to have multifamily housing here, and we're going to have a minimum lot size of half an acre, right? Where the land prices alone essentially are a form of economic segregation that says, we don't want young families here. We don't want the teachers and the nurses who are taking care of our families to live alongside us, right? So if you allow each community to tailor its rules, what you end up with is that the wealthiest, the most privileged communities wall out young families, they wall out civil service workers, you end up with a kind of economically segregated landscape. If you tell everybody you've got to play by the same set of rules, if you're going to designate a single family neighborhood or a neighborhood that can have only say three story structures in it, then like everybody, whether it's a city, whether it's a suburb, can designate that residential, you know, this is our residential district. You can have, single family homes and duplexes with a minimum lot size of a couple thousand feet. Then everybody's playing by the same set of rules. And it doesn't matter, you know, sort of how wealthy the community is. People get to choose where they want to live.
Let me get Taya's response to this idea.
So I think two things. One, because I also looked at Tokyo as a really good example, I think they're hard to compare. One, in Japan, they have a national approach. Their approach is also what they call nuisance-based zoning. So they try to figure out early on across the country how annoying is this one category. He's like, Yoni mentioned, there's these 10 categories, and then you can do whatever you can as long as you don't hit their maximum nuisance level, which allows developers to build by right and a much more flexibility than we have right now. I think the problem here in the United States is we have very prescriptive zoning and prescriptive housing regulations that start to limit activities at the ground. So while I don't know that the state approach would work in our current two-party system, I do think having more flexibility is something that we absolutely
do. Like the outcome. You're not sure if that process will get us there here in Pennsylvania.
I don't think it's as applicable.
Yeah. Mo, what are your thoughts on the idea of sort of like the state being the arbiter of the rules instead of the locality?
I think that the states need to play a way bigger role than it is today. I think preemptive zoning on the state level is going to be a very important part of the solution. I'll give you a simple example. I think it's idea number two, so let me
let me just bring this up before we move on.
Right.
A lot of people will say this just does not feel American. It doesn't feel small D democratic. The idea that many Americans come up believing is that at the local level, our community, we have control.
We get a say.
We get a say, and that the higher levels of government can't override, except in rare circumstances. I mean, Ty, I want you to speak to that. I think a lot of people will feel like we should get to set the rules about what types of things are built in our community.
I think that is exactly how people feel. I think that's the RCO process. That's how people vote on referendums and ideas. I do think we need to do better public education on all of these different aspects of how we do this work. I think we need to lean on our experts. I think as a person that sits in a lot of rooms with a lot of men in suits, we don't even listen to ourselves internally.
Yeah.
And I think we have the components to solve the problem. We don't have the right people at table solutioning together. I think that's why co-design and getting the right players in the room, including the public and including the voice of the public, is critical.
Yeah. So,
Let's move on to
the big idea.
Idea number two. But first, here's a suggestion from the audience. David on YouTube says maybe we can convert shopping malls into affordable condos and apartments. That's David's idea. And Ricky from Philly is one of our callers. Let's bring in Ricky real quick. If you could keep it brief, Ricky, what's your idea for bringing down housing costs?
So I actually just wanted to point out that there are a lot of great grant programs in Philadelphia specifically towards purchasing a home. There's the Philly First Front Door grant that I actually personally used contributed almost $25,000 towards my home, towards purchasing my home. There are also programs that if you buy a home like I did that needed some work, for instance, we needed all new electrical run and we just got that all done for free through a grant program. And we needed a new heating system last year, and we got that done for free through the same grant program, through PHDC. So there are options for people. I'm not by any means saying that it's easy. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of consistency and persistence to contact these places, and it shouldn't be as hard as it is. But there are things out there if you are able to and willing to look for them.
Yeah, that gets to the education part of it, too.
Congratulations to Ricky.
Ricky, educating all of us. Thank you so much for that call. All right, Mo, let's get to your first idea now. This is an interesting one. It is a state-level idea. It's about the state of Pennsylvania specifically issuing loans to developers who might be on the cusp, I think, of building affordable housing but don't quite have the financing to get there. That's very, very broad the way I laid it out. So you get into the details. How would this program work and what would it do to expand affordable housing?
So let me start by first articulating where the problem is.
Yes.
In the U.S., and let's talk about nationally, we're building about 1.2 to 1.5 million homes a year. We also need to know that the shortage that we have is about 3.5 to 4 million homes.
We're way short.
We have.
Yeah.
Now, if you'd ask a lot of people where that shortage is coming from in terms of an affordability level, most people will say, well, it's low-income housing. Mm-hmm. The answer is it is not low-income housing. Mm-hmm. It's only 10 to 15% of that number is low-income housing. Believe it or not, your number one category that is suffering from that shortage is workforce housing. Mm-hmm. It is the housing that is for your average median income in a lot of our cities.
Yeah.
It's for the person that's making $60,000 a year or
$70,000 a year. Not a rich person, not a low-income person, right. Somewhere in the middle.
Correct.
Yeah. And, that's the housing that's not getting built right now.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the reason is that there's a lot of programs for low-income. For example, let's take Philadelphia as an example. You've got the Philadelphia Housing Authority that takes care of a lot of the low-income housing needs that we have.
And then the private market takes care of the wealthy people.
Wealthy people.
Exactly.
But right. The workforce folks have no one.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how do we get the shovels in the ground on this, Mark?
Perfect. So your number one driver for getting affordable housing, when I say affordable, I mean affordable to the median income person, mm-hmm. is to really encourage the private sector. The private sector does 93% of the building nationwide. That's mm-hmm. a stat. Meaning that when you talk about subsidies, when you talk about grants, while they are extremely useful, but they are not scalable solutions.
Mm. And so how do you encourage them?
Exactly. So now you have to look at the muscle that you have in the development industry and you say, the muscle is the private sector. How can I get the private sector to actually produce more homes for the workforce? The private sector is a much simpler way. They have a much simpler way of financing their projects than, let's say, nonprofits or companies that require a lot of subsidies.
Right.
Their source of financing is simple. It's banks and it's equity, just when you like buy a home.
And investors.
It's a mortgage and investors.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the issues that we have seen over the last, since COVID, is that the equity requirement or the down payment, if you will, if you want to speak about it in very, very broad terms, has shot up nearly double. Meaning mm-hmm. if you're looking at a $50 million job, where we used to need $10 million from investors, today it's 20.
Mm-hmm.
What that does is it puts pressure on the financing of these jobs. And that is why in the city of Philadelphia, for example, you have 8,500 permits that are issued and that are sitting on the sidelines.
So you have all this housing that could be built that's not being built because there's an equity problem. So how do you close that gap?
Beautiful. All right. So, and where does that equity, why is that equity not working? It's mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, if I ask you, Sherry, if I say, hey, listen, why don't you give me $10,000 to invest with me? You're going to require at least a 15% on your money every year, right? Yeah. Or else you would just...
In order to take the risk, I need a big return.
I need a...
That's what an investor would say.
Right.
Now, the state might say, I don't need as big a return. That's exactly. where Mo's ideas is coming
in. Exactly.
Here. Okay.
So now you're sitting on a lot of properties where the actual developers are sitting on land that they own outright.
Yep.
But they haven't done the work. Yeah.
But they cannot get it done. So if the state issues a bond, that bond is going to cost the state... whatever it is, 4.5% or 5%, right? We're saying lend that money out with the same amount or even more, make it 6% or 7%. So you're replacing investor money mm-hmm. with a subordinate loan by the state.
So the state will get its money back with the interest paid, but they're not going to require 15% return on investment. They're just going to require maybe 5-7% return on investment.
Exactly. And if you do that and mm-hmm. you put some restrictions on it, saying, hey, listen, one, it has to apply for all homes that have existing permits that are sitting on the sidelines.
Yep.
You can get that housing on the street within 6 months through an RFP
process. So you're saying they would unclog this, I guess, a buildup.
Immediately.
So in order to get access to the money, the developer would have to pledge to a certain percent to be affordable.
I say 100%.
100%.
100% affordable up to 120% AMI.
Got it.
So the workforce housing.
Workforce housing.
Mm-hmm. So they'd have to, 100% of what they're building would have to meet this definition, and they'd have to build it quickly. Otherwise, they're not getting the money from the state.
100%.
So you have to have the permits already.
You have to have the permits already because you don't want that program to cause developers going and buying land and driving up
and
land prices.
Big pie in the sky. How many, if this were to happen, if you were the king of this loan program, right? Low interest, low program. How many developments or how many units do you think this, if in 6 months, this would open up?
8,500 in the city of Philadelphia alone. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about nationwide, there's 500,000 homes that are permitted and has not started. And it shows that if we have a low interest loan, or a reduction in construction costs, you can call this kind of like equated to the low interest loan, you would get 80% of these homes immediately.
Here's my question from the state, because I'm now stepping into the place of the investor and taking the risk, and I'm not getting as much money back. I'm just trying to basically net out at zero.
Yeah. Right.
if people do these projects and they fail, I'm taking on that risk. Would I be left holding the bag at the end of the day if the projects don't go according to plan?
Right. So typically programs like these will have a reserve fund that we're going to have, you know, 5% that are going to fail.
Yeah.
Overall, you should be coming, the state actually comes out of this really in a gain. And the reason is not that they're getting that money paid by the developers in terms of the cost of the bond, but when you have 8,500 units starting,
let's say, paying taxes.
You're paying taxes, sales taxes. You've got about 30,000 jobs that are created that are paying
construction
wage
jobs,
tax,
you're saying, yeah.
Economic impact.
Yeah.
And
it's also clearing up, people can buy housing, things are moving.
Yeah. 100%. And one of the things, and I want to really end with this on that solution, is we talk a lot about solutions that, you know, are zoning related. I respect zoning changes. We've seen, for example, in the city of Philadelphia, how Mayor Parker has really taken on some zoning changes past tier one, past tier two. Now she's going to be working on tier three zoning changes. But at the end of the day, these streamlining of processes are great.
Yeah.
But they're not going to be your scalable solution that is going to be bringing thousands of homes here. You need something that is bold. You need something that is out of the box. Revolving funds have been done elsewhere, and they work.
And Ty, I know you work in the space. Quickly, we're about to come up on a break, but love to get your reaction and response to this.
I think this is a bold idea, but Mo is always full of bold ideas. I think my big question, though, is who's going to pay for this bond, right? I think we've had a hard time getting other bonds off the ground in Philadelphia. I think of the soda tax from a few years ago. And, like, where do you think that we're going to get the momentum to move that?
It's a lot of money.
I think you get the support of the Democrats in the House, and I think you get the support of the Republicans in the Senate. Why? Because there is no end cost to the taxpayers. The cost of the bond will be
there. But there is some upfront. Someone's going to have to put some money up front.
$1 billion, that's coming through a bond. So really what goes into the budget is the service, the debt service on the bond. Mm-hmm. So let's say the bond is at 5% and you're doing a $1 billion, that's only $50 million that is going to be paid by the developers.
All right. Well, we've got many more ideas to come, including Tyler Wynn's first big idea.
Yeah,
we have some of your ideas to get through here. So we'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Don't go anywhere. All right, welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. Thanks for being here. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It is our monthly Big Fix episode, and we are talking about ways to solve the housing crisis. Millions of people are struggling to pay rent, to buy a house. There's a shortage of supply and building costs. They are high. We have three guests with us offering their ideas for ways out of this crisis, and we've been debating them. With us are Taya Nguyen, Executive Director of the Community Design Collaborative. We have Yoni Applebaum, Deputy Executive Editor of The Atlantic. We also have Mo Rushdie, Managing Partner of the River Wards Group.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. How do you think we can make housing more affordable? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the live chat. Max from Downingtown says, at the Philly Navy Yard, there are lots of boats. Could they be used for housing?
Yeah.
Out-of-the-box idea. I love it, Max. Luann from Glenside says, the word amenities is part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Younger generations are focused on living like celebrities as opposed to living modestly. The starter home shortage is a real problem, but people need to temper their living expectations as well. A couple of interesting thoughts
Very interesting.
And so, speaking of thoughts.
Yes. So we're going to go back to your first, very first idea, Taya. We hear the phrase affordable housing constantly, but you argue we're measuring affordability all wrong. Explain what you mean and then lay out your big idea.
Absolutely. So everybody, when you say the word affordable, has a different number in their head that it means to them, right? What it means to me or Mo or either of you, different number, right? I think, first of all, the first issue is that we define affordability based on HUD statistics, right?
So the Housing and Urban Development federal government. Yeah.
So government sets the metric. The metric right now is 80% of the area median income. So you're doing double math to get to the number, right? Mm-hmm. So area median income right now, it's also done at the metropolitan statistical area. So It's not Philadelphia. It's not your neighborhood. It's not your block.
It's the whole Delaware Valley, essentially.
It's Camden, Philadelphia, and Wilmington combined.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a big number covering a lot of area. And we know there's a lot of diversity in incomes just in Philadelphia alone. Does not account for that. So I think part of the problem is that we're losing a lot of people. Also, I teach this in my class at Temple, right? We talk about median income. My students are always like, oh, it's the average. It's not the average. The median means you took all of the people, all of the incomes, lined them up, and you just went to the number in the middle. So 50% is below the number, 50% is above the number. They could be a dollar above the number. They could be $100 above the number. They could be $50 million above the number. We don't know where. So I think part of the problem with our metric is we're leaving out 50% of the population.
And why is this number so important for a lot of people who don't really understand why this number that you're talking about and the calculation around it is so important?
So this number determines anybody that's going to get any access to federal support, city support, state support, have to follow that number. So that 80% of the AMI, which for Philadelphia right now is $68,750 for a family of one, it's $98,150 for a family of four. That is what defines a household as low income. And you probably have a lot of people who are close to making $100,000 who just heard me say they're low income and were shocked, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that is the only way that you can unlock any of those subsidies. Any of that support, public housing, this is how you get SNAP benefits. Everything is determined.
And so, Taya, how would you calculate this number? Because you're saying the way they do it now, wrong, too much math, it ain't mathing. How
the math is not mathing at all. So I think we need to determine it at an individual basis based on actual people's budgets. I think we need to set the standard. If we want it to be 30% of what people are making, we need to just calculate it at what they have at 30%. I also think we need to be looser. Right now, the number only includes some utilities and either your rent or your mortgage. It does not account for your property taxes, your wage taxes, your municipal taxes. If you have debt, medical bills, if you have to pay to send your kids to school, your car, if you need the car to get to work to make the paycheck, none of that currently is factored in that number.
Now, the net of this would be more people would be eligible for subsidies.
More people would be eligible. We'd also know how many people needed support.
Yeah. So let me turn this. Yoni, we haven't heard from you in a while. I want to first get the reaction to the idea of just calculating it differently, but also the downstream effect of just making more people available for various types of government subsidies that help them with housing costs.
Look, subsidies are a really important part of the picture. There's probably no world in which we can just, at a market rate, build enough housing to help everyone. But that said, we can't subsidize our way out of a supply shortage. Ultimately, what drives this is that many more people want to live in the most desirable communities than there is presently housing to accommodate them. And we can increase the subsidies and they can eat a larger and larger share of local or federal budgets. Or we can build the housing that brings the costs down and lets us focus those subsidies on the people in greatest need. And so while I'm a big fan of subsidies and thinking capaciously about affordability, there is a risk if our strategy prioritizes subsidization, that we make the problem worse, that people with increased subsidies are competing then for the housing against those who are still paying market rates, driving up costs, increasing shortages, shutting more people out of desirable places to live. And so I think it's got to be a piece of the solution, but yeah. There's a bigger picture here. And really, unless we radically increase the available supply of housing, I'd go much further than the numbers we heard earlier. I think we're probably about 15 million homes short because many of the homes are in the wrong places. They're not where Americans actually want to live.
And Taya, you want to respond to that?
I would say yes and. So one, I agree. Subsidies are not going to solve the problem, but we need better data, right? If we can tell developers this is what people can afford, we know exactly the numbers they can hit, they can design products that meet those needs.
So let me push back a little bit on that.
Okay, Mo.
All right. So I'm a developer, right? There is, it's good in theory, but if let's say we're talking about the median income in the city of Philadelphia is, let's say on the 80%, is 60,000. 60,000, and we call the cost burden is 30% of that, which means $18,000 a year, which means I have to have a rent of $1,500, which really means that I have to build something that I can service the debt, for $1,000 a month. That means that I have to build a unit for $130,000. Now, that solution is out the door. It requires deep subsidies. So we're back to the same question.
But the government could conceivably, look, tax people more like they could fill that gap, right? Conceivably.
Conceivably, they can. But let's be realistic, Avi. I mean, we're talking about 4 million. We're talking about 7% of what you are building receive subsidies. 7%. Again, we're focusing on the 7%. We are forgetting that 50% of the shortage is going to people who are actually leaving the city of Philadelphia, people who are making 50, 60, 70,000, they're crossing the river, they're leaving the city.
But would better data help you? Like the data that Ty is talking about, would that help you build better products for the workforce or for a population, or better target a specific population?
When we talk about data, I think, again, I'll be a little bit on the aggressive side. We have a lot of the demographic data. We do have 10 council districts in the city of Philadelphia. We know how some of the districts are extremely poor. But we also are faced with, let's be realistic, municipalities are not able to help the sub 30% AMI across the nation. That is why the federal subsidies are the one that actually step in. So we go back to what can we do? Let us not have the perfect idea or, you know, be the enemy of a good idea. What we're saying is, what can we scale?
Yeah.
What can we scale? When I tell you have a $4 million home shortage, answer me with what can we do to bring that shortage to fruition? Meaning it would take us 8 years if we increase our production by 500,000 homes. So I go back to our guest when he said we need to find ways to lower construction cost. That is
the cost down.
Real quick response, Ty, before we move on to the next idea.
Yeah, I think my question is, if 1,500 is the number that Mo came up with, the average rent right now in Philadelphia is $1,376, and that includes market rate, right? But Zillow has it listed at $1,625. So there's still something out there in the data that we do have available that tells me that developers are still building at a higher income level or a higher level of finish than most people can afford. I don't think that we don't have units. I think we have units that are too expensive, and I think a lot of them are owned by LLCs and owned by investment property groups.
Can I get that real quick? Because we do have a couple people commenting on this idea that one way to make things more affordable is, like Stan says, ban hedge funds from buying up tracts of housing. Aaliyah said national policy to make it illegal for private equity orgs to own residential housing. Real quick response to that as an idea to the affordability crisis, just because it's come up multiple times in our comments.
I think it's necessary, right? I think there's cities that have already started to do this. I think it's changed a lot. I live in Cobbs Creek right now in Philadelphia. Last year, there was a big news story that said 76 properties had been bought in Cobbs Creek. And overnight, I got emails from Zillow and said that my value of my house had gone up. And when we did AVI this year, my taxes went up too, and it went up almost $400 a month. So I do think that is a very real experience for everybody here in Philadelphia, and I'm assuming if it's happening here, it's happening in other cities.
I agree.
Yeah. So let's move on to Yoni's second idea, Yoni Applebaum. Your second idea is about loosening mortgage lending. So why is that going to help sort of alleviate the problem?
You know, one thing that we've been talking about today is the difficulty of families with solid incomes purchasing or accessing the housing that they need. This is a relatively new problem. You know, we're not talking about you know, the families that need the deepest subsidies, but people with holding down good jobs, they have solid incomes. Up until the 2008 financial crisis, the policy of the federal government was to provide them with mortgage financing to put home ownership within their reach. And there was an entire industry devoted to building the starter homes that they would typically acquire. I hold no brief for single family homes. Somebody wants to live in an apartment, they want to buy a condo, that's great. But realistically in America, that is often where the development has gone, where people get that first foot on the housing ladder. And we tightened up the mortgage lending. in a largely false belief about what had caused the financial crisis. And these days, you need much higher credit scores in order to access federally subsidized home loans. You need often, some of the more exotic products were, I think, regulated out of existence, which was good. But even, sort of the plain vanilla mortgages these days are way out of reach of many families with these solid incomes.
Now, Yoni, just to cut you off, a lot of people that might have like watched The Big Short or something and said, this was the problem, right? We gave money to people at way too cheaper rates to people who couldn't really afford their mortgages. Those mortgages went under and there was a housing crisis, and we're still living in the shadow of that today. You're saying that's the wrong diagnosis, or it's an oversimplification?
Yeah, I'm saying it's the wrong diagnosis. To a very large extent, that there were problematic loans in that era, but they involved things often like option arms, where people were taking loans out or getting loans from lenders that relied on their having a higher income down the road or being able to refinance down the road. That was never a great idea. But we didn't just tighten up that stuff, right? We tightened up the credit scores. We tightened up a lot of the down payment assistance rules. And in the process, we didn't just go back to sort of like housing policy before some of the Wild West stuff that was happening in the early 2000s. We rolled way back. It has never been this hard.
And Yoni, you said that this is basically an overcorrection. So how would you fix it? How would you sort of have a balance between having protection so that we don't have another bubble burst, but also making sure that mortgages are accessible to people who want to be able to buy a home?
Yeah, you could put the credit score guidelines back to where they were. It was not the low credit scores that got folks in trouble. It was some of the exoticized products. It was the derivatives that crashed the markets. The problem was not, people can have imperfect credit histories and still be really good risks. So we can lower the credit scores. We can loosen some of the tightened guidelines around down payment assistance and other subsidy programs that help get people into those homes. There's just a missing market. We're not building starter homes in America, and that squeezes everybody. One reason that you're seeing private equity and other capital move into housing markets is that it is an artificial government monopoly, right? Like, we have made it really, really hard to provide new supply, and private equity is predatory. If the government's going to guarantee it a high rate of return, it's going to move in. But it's responding to a problem there, which is lots of people can afford the monthly payment on what would have gotten them their own home 20 years ago, but there are no homes for that amount anymore. And so they are stuck paying rent. So you're seeing private equity move into single family markets, snap up those homes and rent
we'll
them
take
back
that rent. Yeah. Yeah. Mo, your response to this idea that perhaps we went a little too far after the housing bubble burst and made it too hard for too many people to get mortgages.
Right. And that's why in the city of Philadelphia, we have the best program in the country. You can buy a single family home for less than $1,000 down payment and a $1,200 a month payment for a three-bedroom, two-bathroom, single-family home with a backyard. That does not exist anywhere in America. It exists in Philadelphia. And that was done through the major investment. I'm sure you've heard about the recent home initiative by Mayor Parker and investing hundreds of million dollars in something called the Turnkey Project, which is basically lowering the cost of the home by given away city land as long as you are building a home that is specs-wise acceptable, new construction, and you're going to be buying it at a fixed number, and the city of Philadelphia is going to give you $75,000 as a soft second.
But how much of that is, it seems like that is not accessible to all the people who need a house.
I would say that the average buyer today makes $48,000 a year. That's $23 to $24 an hour. Okay. People are able to buy single family homes as their starter homes. That does not exist anywhere. Yeah. And it has helped right now over 1,000 people. It could be scaled. It is expensive. Okay. But the good things about it is not only are you able to buy that starter home, Sherry, what happens is it causes a lot of stability in these neighborhoods by having people stay in these neighborhoods for at least 15 years so that $75,000 can go away.
Yeah, and your thoughts quickly, because we're coming up on a break.
Yeah, I mean, I think the city had done this before. We did it through PHDC back in the 90s, and I think when the neighborhoods were improving at a pace that made sense, that did work out. But there are also a lot of these homes that were abandoned and people figured out their out provision or rented them out. And I do think there are instances in other cities where these all become Airbnbs. And I think we're going to have to navigate that, like where we put them, what we're doing, how they match, and how we kind of integrate these back into the community.
And I, as chair of the PHDC, I can tell you that there are systems now in place to make sure that everyone is living in.
And we're going to put a pin in this, and we're going to continue our conversation on the other side of this break. We have two more big ideas from our big thinkers coming up. How do you think we can make housing more affordable? You can give us a call and chime in, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today we have our monthly Big Fix series where we get ambitious ideas for the country's thorniest problems. But before we get back to our conversation about how to make housing more affordable, it is now time to reveal this week's Giveaway Wednesday event. Charlie, hit it.
That is the sound of renowned Talking Heads tribute band Start Making Sense. They'll be in KOP for the Concerts Under the Stars series on Saturday, August 22nd. A pair of tickets to the show will run you $70. But to be the fourth person who emails us now at studio2@whyy.org, and you'll get a pair for free on us.
Don't you just like free stuff?
I do like free.
Yeah. So now back to our big questions of the day. How do you think we can make housing more affordable? Should we change zoning rules? Should we just build? What are your thoughts? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTubers, you can keep those comments coming in the live chat.
This hour, we've been talking with Taya Nguyen, Executive Director of the Community Design Collaborative, Yoni Applebaum, Deputy Executive Editor of The Atlantic, and Mo Rushdie, Managing Partner of the River Wards Group. And Mo, idea number two that you have brought to us has to do with state-issued zoning preemptive bills that would allow for unlimited height and density, no parking requirements for folks building 100% affordable along commercial corridors and public transportation routes. So basically, opening things up along transportation routes. Why?
Well, it solves many issues. Yeah. One, I've built many naturally occurring affordable housing in areas like Kensington and areas like Port Richmond. Believe it or not, these podiums are pretty much vacant. They cost millions for parking, and a lot of people do not use them. Mm-hmm. It's a younger generation. They don't use car. They use car share, bikes, scooters, all kinds of stuff. So these parking requirements are so outdated. So that's number one. Number two is you have a problem with SEPTA. You have a problem with the funding of SEPTA. You have a problem with ridership, right? Why are we not concentrating housing where it needs to be concentrated? Number one, you are going to have people who do not like to see apartment buildings in the middle of single-family home neighborhoods. So you're actually putting density where density is needed. When I go into commercial corridors, guys, and I see 30-foot-high buildings, I'm just heartbroken because these are the corridors that needs big buildings, high density, you know, restaurants, cafes. That's urbanism, where you see the commercial corridors and where you see the lines of the public transportation, that's where we need the density. Currently, currently, TUD has improved by the city through Alleviation legislation. The state has done its own.
Now, this would be
TUD.
Train routes and bus routes.
Yes.
Now, bus routes, that's like, in some neighborhoods, that's like every street, Mo.
Yeah,
that's like
a lot of
that's
streets,
like, that's like,
yeah.
You know, I'm living in a row home neighborhood in South Philly. I'm probably on a bus route.
It has to be on the ridership. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the ridership. But what I would say is right now, for example, our TUD is based on 13 stations only in the whole of city of Philadelphia.
Right.
Okay. That's a problem. You need to increase that radius, and you need to increase the number of stations. And if you give me...
So theoretically, though, if I wanted to build 100% affordable, I could build a 50-story tower on an any bus route in Philadelphia.
But it's not going to work. So let's be realistic,
okay,
too.
Okay.
All right.
No, it wouldn't work for the developer.
It will not work for the developer because at the end of the
day. But technically, it would be allowed.
It technically would be allowed. But who's going to build a 50-story steel construction at $900 an hour to build 120% AMI housing? Not going to happen. Right. These are going to end up being 5- and 6-story buildings mm-hmm. with no podiums. Okay. Smaller units, 500, 600 square feet that you can actually guarantee that you're seeing units sub $1,500.
Yeah,
gotta get your response to this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a beautiful thought. I don't think it's, I think you guys have pulled out some of the already practical applications. I do think we need to densify around mm-hmm. transit. I agree. Mm-hmm. I do think we need to invest more in transit. I don't think you can talk about housing without talking about transit. I think they go hand in hand, and we need to fix both in the city. But we're not talking about transit today. That could be a future.
It's on the list.
Right.
It's on the list.
But I do think we need to get rid of parking. I think we do parking a lot.
So this is the requirement the parking that when you build, let's say, 8 units, let's put a number, you have to provide 8 parking spots. Essentially, that's...
It used to be 10, right?
Used to be 10,
you got to assume people are visiting the people that you're building for.
And that's a requirement, and you're saying get rid of that.
Or you're building a $4 million podium to build 150 units. That ends up basically increasing everyone's rents by $150.
Because they have to build the parking spots,
because you got to build that
and
podium.
And some people don't even have cars if you have around transportation. And Yoni, quickly, if you want to comment on this as we pivot to our final idea.
Yeah, I think transit-oriented development is a great idea, and anything we can do to sort of concentrate the development around places the transit's already serving is going to be a win-win.
All right, so
all right.
Taya,
and
you're bringing us home.
Taya, last one. You were talking about create a supply and diversity of housing. Break it down for us.
I think we need more housing types. I think
yes.
we have...
And what does that mean?
Yes, so right now we focus on single-family housing. We focus on a 2.5-bedroom, 2.5-bath row house. And yes, that is the majority of Philadelphia. I have a row house. I think it's beautiful. But we have a lot of different family types. We have a lot of different family sizes. We have a lot of different ways that people live. And outside of the United States, every other country is utilizing all of the tools in the toolbox.
Give me some of the more types. Yeah. I want to, because I'm so intrigued by this.
Co-housing. Think of friends, right? You first get out of college, you're getting your first job, you're living with 3 or 4 of your friends in an apartment or a house where you're each kind of contributing to the household. This was the starter home for a lot of people. And a lot of these very conventional ways that people live, we have gotten rid of. Think of grandma living above the garage. Think of your cousins. A lot of immigrant families will bring people over and like people are living in like a smaller space for a period of time until they stabilize and get their own space. We have made a lot of that either very expensive and very difficult to get done in Philadelphia or illegal.
Give an example.
What's illegal?
So right now you cannot have an ADU in almost, which is an accessory dwelling unit. For a lot of people, that would be a granny flat, a conversion of the backyard.
An ensuite, yeah.
In almost any zoning designation, it is not possible.
Yeah. Well, no. But part of the aging rules in Pennsylvania has been to create this, change the zoning laws to allow more people to age in homes. So you thinking this should happen a lot sooner?
Absolutely. I also think we talk about adaptive reuse. We've had a lot of controversy in Philadelphia over the office building to apartment building conversion. A lot of those can't happen by right, right? So it's this lengthy, expensive process. Developers have to come back to the city to get approval.
And I want to mention one very important point. Mm-hmm. The local politicians are under a lot of pressure from their communities.
Sure.
So when we say preemptive state legislations, you are taking a lot of pressure off of our local politicians if there is a general agreement on the recipe for solving affordable
but
housing.
But also taking power out of their hands, too.
As long as you...
And out of community hands.
You are partially right. But when you deal with a crisis, when you deal with an emergency... Okay. Sometimes you have to do what Mayor Bass did in LA, okay, with her ED1 and take some measures, which did upset some people, but that quadrupled in 1 year the supply of affordable housing.
And I'm seeing a thread here because everybody hates zoning regulation on this panel. Yeah.
I don't hate it.
I also say
as a zoning board member of the city of Philadelphia, I don't think I can. I think zoning is the base regulation that runs in any place. how things are built. I think our current zoning code is just slightly outdated. I also think it's not very forward thinking. I think a lot of the typologies that I would suggest aren't currently happening in Philadelphia because they're not allowed.
I'm just confused. Like, why are things like accessory dwelling units like not allowed in Philadelphia? Mm-hmm. What's the
row house lot, right? We have very small lots. Yeah. We don't have alleys. If you have a person living at the rear of your property, how are they getting out? How many of you are looking at an overgrown 3-foot alley that you share with the neighbor behind you?
For fire, yeah. For
how are we getting? How are we getting them out? How are you building this? You're not going to put a crane in front of your house in South Philly to port all the stuff over. So, like, some of this is built by the fabric of our city. This is just how Philadelphia is.
But you're saying it shouldn't be illegal to do it. If there was a way to do it with mm-hmm. with property.
We need more pathways to yes. We need more pilots. We need more instances where we can test new things, because there are some instances people figure out ways to get things to work, and our system isn't designed for hackers.
Real quick, Yoni Applebaum, as we get ready to wrap up, your thoughts on just making it easier to build more different types of experimental housing that doesn't fit in this sort of manufactured box we have?
I love all these efforts. We need a lot more types of housing, but at the end of the day, if our solution to a incredibly complicated set of rules is to craft lots of bespoke loopholes through which we hope that homeowners and developers can jump, we're going to end up with the same problem. The only way forward, in my view, is to radically simplify the actual rules and make sure that everybody's got a level.
Well, look, we've got to leave it there. But this was a really interesting conversation. So interesting. Heard a lot of ideas. And I want to thank our guest. That was Yoni Applebaum, Deputy Executive Editor at The Atlantic. Thank you, Yoni, for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mo Rushdie, Managing Partner of the River Wards Group. Mo, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Taya Nguyen, Executive Director of the Community Design Collaborative. So nice to see you. So nice to have you.
Appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Yeah, and thank you to everybody who called in, wrote in. Lots of interesting ideas online. And of course, we couldn't do any of what we do without our producers. So thank you so much to Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Ben Abrams, Charlie Kyer, and Mike Schiffler engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
Time for two more ideas. Michael says develop tax credits based on long-term tenancy. VJ says there needs to be more processes for keeping developers accountable. I'll leave you with those two from Michael and VJ. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow. And tomorrow at noon on Studio 2, why is Gen Z taking up so-called granny hobbies like knitting, quilting, and birdwatching? If you look online, you'll find a whole new generation of enthusiasts posting about their favorite analog pastimes or showing off half-done craft projects for hashtag Work in Progress Wednesday.
Yeah, and so what's behind this growing appreciation for slow and tactile hobbies? And what does the science say about their potential health benefits? I know, I'm a gardener.
I mean, we're on radio, hey, so we love old school. Old school hobbies, have at.
All of that's coming up tomorrow. Coming up next on WHYY, we have Here and Now. See you on the radio tomorrow.